This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. To create your own space, visit squarespace.com and save 10% by using offer code TREK8. And also by TrekFan. It's not just a fan club, it's an adventure. You'll explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. Don't miss out. Help move us toward the Star Trek future by visiting TrekFan.org. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit Trek.fm/donate to get our new alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me once again this week, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Now, Matthew, I'm looking at the screen, I'm looking at the background behind you there, and you know, your room seems racked with chaos. It could use some order.
You know, Chris, it really could, and you're not lying, actually. There is laundry all over the place. I was, you know, doing laundry this afternoon when I got home from work, and so I'm thinking that what I need is just a big map of my room, and then I can, you know, figure out where I'm going to have the task forces come in from, you know, and which way they're going to attack, you know. Do I flank them? Do I come from the side? You know, surround them. I don't know how best to solve this problem. What do you think, Chris?
Right. I don't know. So you're going to figure out, you know, how you're going to attack the laundry problem, how you're going to attack the dish problem, how you're going to get those books in order over there. It sounds like a good plan, but you know, imposing your type of order on your room, it may prove more difficult than you imagine.
I'm worried about this, Chris, because I don't want this to be a problem. I just want the mess fixed.
Right. And you don't want it to turn into a 2-year conflict with all the disorder in your room, right?
At that point, I'm just going to start breaking plates. You know, I'm just going to throw them on the floor and, you know, I'm never going to do laundry again. I'm just going to buy new clothes. Yeah. I mean, that could fix the problem, right?
And you know those neighbors that you have that they don't really like you very much? You might have to trick them into joining in with your effort to clean up your room.
Oh, goodness. I think that's going to be the hardest part, Chris, because really trying to get my neighbors involved in this, we don't have the, closest relationship. I guess we get along okay. You know, I really don't want to have to frame anyone and right, maybe accidentally, you know, have a senator die with falsified information that now looks real because their ship blew up. This is getting tough.
You know, this whole scenario, it sounds an awful like the Dominion War on Deep Space Nine.
It's funny because actually, Chris, it sounds exactly like the Dominion War on Deep Space Nine.
It really does. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the Dominion War. And of course, the Dominion War is too huge to really talk about in depth in one show. So what we're going to focus on today is the impact that the Dominion War had on certain characters as well as on different worlds and the Federation and kind of what is the aftermath of the Dominion War.
Well, Chris, you know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting, and we're just kind of talking in general here, the setup for the Dominion War. You know, the writers had different setup in mind. And then the studio came in and said, well, we'd really like you to put Worf on the show. And so it really set back what they had planned, and they had to go a different way. And yet, when I watch through the show, honestly, I feel like it feels organic where they end up going.
It does. Yeah. It's interesting. Like, I can see Worf coming on the show as setting them on a course where they had to do more Worf stories and they had to kind of integrate him with the crew. But like you say, it does feel organic, doesn't it? It feels like because of the way the war played out, and of course, this is always when you look at something in hindsight, you can see it this way. It's hard to imagine the Dominion War without Worf coming on the show, because Worf was, he was brought on to help deal with the Klingons because the Klingon presence was going to be increased because of the threat from the Dominion. And I can't imagine the Dominion War without Worf and Martok and the Klingon fleets. I don't know how that would have had, how would it have played out?
Well, and what I think it does, Chris, is that they are able to use it to their advantage. That
yeah.
the Klingon-Cardassian War is really been something that's been used by the Dominion to create conflict. And we've already seen this, too. We already saw the Dominion trick the Romulans and the Cardassians into going into the Delta Quadrant and destroying their entire fleet. I mean, decimating the Obsidian Order, really, and the Tal Shiar. And so really upsetting the Alpha Quadrant powers. So we see that this is how the Dominion likes to work. It likes to destabilize before it actually goes in and conquers. And so, you know, being able to use this war with the Klingons and the Federation was really fantastic. I think it really helped the writers use it to their advantage that in the end, the ultimate threat was really the Dominion, because the Klingons, the Cardassians, and the Federation at this point are all just being used.
Exactly. Yeah. So the setup was great, and it also brought together, it's kind of like that world war feeling here on Earth too, where, you know, you have powers like the United States and the Soviet Union who are enemies, or were enemies at the time, but they come together and they fight together on the same side because there's some greater threat that threatens their very way of life, even though their philosophies were different. You have democracy and you have communism. Still, the threat from the Nazis was greater. It would have impacted both sides, and so they had to come together. And they were able, by bringing Worf on, bringing the Klingons into the mix, ultimately bringing the Romulans, and then in the end, actually having the Cardassians flip sides, they're able to create that same sense of grandeur and conflict between what we call the Alpha Quadrant powers, which of course we know that some of these people, like the Klingons and the Romulans, were in the Beta Quadrant. We know this, but on the show, it's called the Alpha Quadrant powers because it's from the Dominion's perspective, and it's easier to say that way. So it creates that great grand conflict and forces these sides that we're all familiar with to come together. It made such a great story.
Well, and it makes it a galactic event at that point. I mean, this is a galactic war on the scale that we've never seen before in Star Trek, that all of the major powers are involved somehow. And then you throw in minor powers like the Breen and just the mercenaries like that. So it just creates this sense that the entire galaxy is embroiled in this conflict. And the only place that isn't really touched by it at this point is the Delta Quadrant, because the Gamma Quadrant is fully involved because they keep sending ships from the Dominion. So I think this is one of those things where it changed the game. It changed Star Trek. And what it really does, and I think we've talked about this a little bit before, but it really helps challenge those Roddenberry ideals. What happens to those kind of ideals when we're put into a situation that's so grim and so dire? How do we live up to those? And Deep Space Nine does a great job with the Dominion War of asking some really tough questions of that philosophy. And I think that that's really important because if you can't have your philosophy be really challenged and it be able to hold up, then it's not a good philosophy to hold to. And so the Dominion War, I think, really creates that sense of fire for that philosophy to go through.
Right. And of course, that's controversial amongst Star Trek fans. And a lot of fans think that Deep Space Nine crossed a line that shouldn't be crossed by doing this. But I think it's important too. And besides just making it an exciting, you know, action-packed war that was taking place on the screen, it's important that I think, you know, Star Trek fans want to live in that Star Trek future. They want to have that world where all these problems have been solved, at least on Earth. And even in the world of Deep Space Nine, with, you know, it's questioned a little bit because you do have cases during the course of this war where the changelings come and they actually infiltrate Earth, or at least they set it up. You know, they have the bombing, you have Homefront and Paradise Lost, and you have that threat of martial law on Earth, and everything isn't totally perfect. But for the most part, you know, Earth is a great place to live. It's certainly a much better place to live than the Earth we live on today. But I think that sometimes Star Trek can set up a false sense of optimism. I don't know if that's the right word or not, but it's like we just think we're going to get there one of these days. And it's just going to be easy, and somehow all the pieces are just going to fall into place. So what I think the Dominion War storyline on Deep Space Nine did really well is that it showed us that we can't become complacent. We can't assume everything's going to be perfect, and we can't become complacent when it is ideal, that you always have to keep fighting to maintain that lifestyle that you want, and to fight for your ideals and what actually makes the fabric of your society work. You can't just assume that it's always going to be there. And fighting doesn't always have to mean open warfare like we get in the Dominion War. You know, it can also just be standing up for your ideals and making hard choices when you have to make sure that you don't compromise your ethics and you don't compromise your ideals.
Well, and I think, you know, Chris, we were talking about this on Literary Treks, because we were talking about Christopher Bennett's new book and just the Starfleet having to figure out, and the Federation having to figure out what it's going to be. And any democracy, any government really has to keep kind of asking those questions of what we're going to be. And after being around for so long, you're going to have huge tests to that. And they definitely have that here with the Dominion War. And I think that it's really good to see them go through this. And I think really the main reason I say this, Chris, is because so many people look up to the Roddenberry ideal as a way of life. And yet I think the Dominion War helps me ask some really serious questions about that as a way of life. And can it really be a valid way of life? Because I think without that kind of questioning, it's you can't say that, oh, I should really live out these principles, because I've never seen it tested. I've never seen it tried and kind of go through the fire and make sure it actually could really work. And the Dominion War puts it through that test. And I think that's really good, because like you said, we don't just want to be naive and just say we want to live in this utopian society when we don't know exactly how that utopian society would actually work under pressure.
Yeah, and under pressure is what is addressed here, right? It's like they did finally build that utopian society, and the Federation was at peace for most of that time. I mean, of course, there are the conflicts that arise here and there, but especially people living on Earth, they weren't really worried about much of anything, I don't think. And then during this war, you know, you get the changeling infiltration that I just mentioned, the Breen attack San Francisco, stuff happens. And then it shows the tenuous nature of even a utopian society. And I'm afraid that Star Trek sometimes paints it all as being too easy and too simple. And that's, again, what I love about DS9 in general. And it's also why I think that this storyline of the Dominion War, even though a lot of fans think there should not be this type of massive war taking place in the Star Trek universe, is really important to just maintaining that Star Trek future in the first place.
Definitely. And Chris, I think it's also really interesting. We really watch this war take its toll on the galaxy and the different races involved. I mean, the Federation, you know, has so many ships destroyed in this war. The Klingons the same way. The Cardassians, I mean, really pay the price for signing a deal with the devil. The Dominion comes in, signs the agreement pact with Cardassia, and you know from the very beginning that, and we all know as viewers, but we can't believe that Zuccott can't see this, that he's just being used, that the Cardassian people, they're just being used for, you know, gain in the Alpha Quadrant to destroy the Alpha Quadrant powers so that the Dominion can rule. I mean, the toll it takes on Cardassia is just astounding.
Well, Zuccott is always in pursuit of power, right? And ultimately, it's about him and his power. And he saw that as an opportunity, I think. And he's kind of short-sighted, but he sees it as an immediate opportunity to restore Cardassia, to get support from the Dominion. And I really think that Zuccott thought that he would somehow be able to turn the table on the Dominion eventually, and that Cardassia would come out on top.
Well, and I mean, we haven't had this big, long discussion about Zuccott, and we won't really go into it here, but I really think it just comes from the fact that he's a megalomaniac. And of course you would think that, because it really is, in the end, it's always about his power and wanting to be in power.
And it's why Damar is such a great character, because in the end, you know, with Damar actually being the salvation of Cardassia, not Zuccott, and Damar being able to overcome all of his prejudice and being able to work with Kira is great, because in Damar, we actually find that it sets Zuccott apart, I think, because it's easy to stereotype Cardassians as being like Zuccott. But with people like Damar, as this war plays out, you can find out that Zuccott he's more like the outlier within the Cardassians. He's the extreme. And Damar, actually, although he's patriotic and although, you know, he's been raised to believe the Cardassians are superior to everyone, you find out that this conflict actually digs down within the Cardassian society as well, and Damar is able to come together as part of the alliance and redeem Cardassians for us, I think, as viewers, and in a way, certainly redeem himself.
Right. Well, I think, too, you know, we really see that as well in Garak. There's the different sides of Cardassians, obviously, and I think that's one of the things that the war really sets up, is that we have only really seen, you know, one type of Cardassian as the kind of the monolithic Cardassian people, which is Zuccott. And yet, you know, as we get into this war, we really see, especially by the end and the resistance with the Cardassians and everything, just who they are as a people, that they're not all just one type of person, which in Star Trek really has a bad habit of doing that with its races, that everybody dresses alike, everybody has the same haircut.
Exactly.
You know, we're all one kind of monolithic type people. We don't have our own thoughts or whatever. Humans are the only one. Deep Space Nine really helps open that up, that there are each race, you know, whether it's Ferengi or human or Romulan, you know, Cardassian, Klingon, there's different types of people in each society. It's not a cookie cutter.
Yeah, Klingon is a great example. I mean, take someone like Martok. You're able to actually see on DS9 the depth of a Klingon, which prior to that, the Klingons were fairly cardboard. You know, they're pretty much, okay, they're this warrior race and they all kind of have the same reaction to everything. They're not very nuanced. And so the Dominion War also allowed us to get a lot of nuance in the Klingons as well. But as for the Cardassians, I mean, if anyone you get the feeling leading up to this, of course, because of Ducat, that the Cardassians were a people who believed that they would fight to the bitter end. But then they realized that the Dominion really will fight to the bitter end. And the Dominion don't care. I mean, the female changeling, she doesn't care. It's like, kill all the Cardassians. We've used them. Their planet has been shattered. And we don't need them anymore. They've betrayed us. Kill them all, you know, every last one. And then the Cardassians realize that, well, this is not what we signed up for. And these people really, truly will fight to the bitter end. And it was just, it's such, they realized, certainly Damar realized that they, like you said, made a deal with the devil. And if anyone, you know, everyone in this war, as you said, paid a heavy price, from Starfleet to the Romulans, the Klingons, to, you know, basically unprotected worlds within the Federation, like Beta Zed, they paid a heavy price. Right. But Cardassia probably paid the heaviest price of anyone that was involved in this conflict.
Well, and I think of that, you know, when you think about at the end of the war, Cardassia has 800 million dead. I mean, yeah. a power completely decimated. So the Dominion War has huge repercussions then for the galaxy at large. You know, Starfleet has to rebuild. The Cardassians will spend years upon years and years rebuilding their society, their home planet. I mean, the Romulans the same way, the Klingons. I mean, every power that is major in the Alpha and Beta Quadrants has been weakened substantially. And then, of course, the Dominion is just decimated. It's done. And so it's a huge toll that this war takes on a majority of the Star Trek galaxy that we know. There's not really a place that hasn't been touched except for, obviously, the Delta Quadrant.
And it drains the resources. Like you said, everyone's been weakened already. And then Cardassia, the decimation of Cardassia, is going to drain the resources of the Federation, because, as you said, you have to go in and rebuild. If you think about here on Earth, you know, if we had a world war now, and let's say Russia or China or India or the United States or some country was decimated, where, say, 90% of the population is killed and their infrastructure is destroyed, and so their financial market is destroyed and their production capacity is destroyed, even if they are our enemy, we have to help them rebuild. You know, well, just the same as after World War II, where we helped rebuild Germany and Japan and countries that were on the Axis side. And of course, the Allied countries also had to do a lot of rebuilding. You couldn't just leave that country that way and continue life as usual, because it impacts everyone and all the interactions. And it's the same thing here on a galactic scale. The Federation, the Klingons, and the Romulans, they can't just leave Cardassia. You know, they always have this fantasy of, like, we'll go in and we'll conquer Cardassia, right? They've tried it. But really, it doesn't work that way. And that's another thing that we get to see. We don't get to really see it on screen, but we know that that is the aftermath of this conflict.
Well, and the amount that they're going to be responsible for is just insane. I mean, in helping to rebuild. And I think, obviously, it's the correlation we've seen between the World War II aspect of the Allied powers really helping to rebuild those Axis powers, and that there is that sense of forgiveness that happens in that. I think is really big and key, and obviously part of something that we would very much see as a Star Trek value and theme. And so that's beautiful, and I like that a lot. Chris, I thought it was one of the interesting things. We kind of just get pulled into this total war, and the war takes a few seasons. It really starts with the fact that the Cardassians have signed this pact with the Dominion, and they keep bringing ships, and they keep bringing more Jem Hadar through, and Sisko and Starfleet decide that they have to mine the wormhole. And they know that if they do that, they're going to be starting a war. But they also know, as Sisko says, we're losing the peace. So either war is really the only option. And I think that that's a really interesting thing, because that's a big question. Like, when is war the best option? And Star Trek makes us wrestle with that question.
Right, because prior to this, you would be led to believe that war is never the right option. And I'd like to believe that personally. You know, I mean, I don't like war. I'm very opposed to resolving things through conflict. But there are times, as we've seen from our own history, where it really can't be avoided. And even in the Star Trek universe, that's going to happen. And so this does make us face that and realize that other Star Trek painting the picture that war is never the right option. And I'm not saying that it always does this, but I'm saying more often than not, that's what we're left with in that idealistic utopian future. I think that as much good as Star Trek gives us, I think that could be harmful too, if that becomes too pervasive a view. And again, I'm not saying you should run out and fight. I'm just saying that we have to accept the reality of our existence, that there are times where that's an option that does have to be considered in the face of some extreme situations, as is the case here with the Dominion.
Well, and it leads to one of the biggest things, you know, the mining of the wormhole, and then the fact that the station gets taken over. And we lose Deep Space Nine. I can't imagine.
Which was awesome that they would do that.
Oh my gosh. I can't imagine like a more gut-wrenching scene than having the station be lost in at the end of that fifth season. And you're just devastated. You know, everybody thought that when Picard was turned into Locutus, you know, it was the worst thing ever. It was the longest summer ever. For me, this was the longest summer, having to wait to see how they were going to get back Deep Space Nine. And then I get back to that season in season six. It takes 6 episodes.
Exactly.
Wow.
And that's fantastic. I love the fact that the station is taken over and it's not just resolved in the next episode. I love the fact that they have to operate without the station for so long. Because that's a real element of realism. I mean, in reality, it might have taken even longer for them to retake the station. But just the fact that in Star Trek, the title station, not a ship in this case, but station of the series, is not in the hands of our heroes.
I think one of the most interesting things, too, when we watch that arc, especially that sixth season arc, is a place where the characters really begin to move forward. Like, we really begin to see how this war is changing people. We watch Odo go through what he does with the female changeling. You know, you watch somebody like Jake learning to be a reporter. He's part of the underground. Honestly, one of my favorite storylines for Jake, the fact that he stays back and becomes part of the resistance. You know, Kira having to deal with the complacency she gets and becoming a collaborator. Yeah. I mean, every character in those 6 episodes has something major happening to them. And it's just fantastic the way the writers use that to really shift where everybody's going to go for the last 2 seasons.
Well, you know, even Nog and Rom and even Quark, you know, getting involved in this resistance as well is something that you wouldn't have really pictured from them prior to this. And I think it shows how the threat to your way of life can really change you and can turn even people who you would never imagine would be warriors into warriors, even if it's through the act of sabotaging the station or using your technical skills to help mine the wormhole, not that you're actually out on a ship fighting, you know, and you're not hand-to-hand combat with the Jem'Hadar or something, but, you know, really changes people. You bring up Kira. Kira is very interesting because it's something, again, that DS9 is able to do with characters that I feel that other Star Trek would not have done, which is that they allow Kira to become complacent and to, in a sense, become a collaborator through her complacency with what's going on. And again, it's something that you wouldn't expect from her because she had spent her life fighting against the Cardassians. But it also, you know, like in our everyday lives, we get into a routine. And sometimes we get into a routine of something that it's not necessarily what we want to do, but it just becomes that we're going through the motions and it's easy. And I think that's what happens to Kira here, is that at first she feels like she can't change the situation. She feels like it's better for her to be there so that she can somehow from the inside affect what's going on. But then she gets into the routine and time starts to pass. And it takes something to snap her out of that.
Well, and I thought it was so interesting that what snaps her out of it is just that she's being handed coffee by a Cardassian. You know, she's being handed her morning rack to Gino. And
that's real, because sometimes it's some really, really, really simple thing like that.
Right.
That snaps you out of something.
Right. And then, of course, she has her whole conflict with Odo. You know, she can't understand why Odo has such a fascination with this female changeling, and Odo can't explain it to her. And honestly, Odo can't see he's being used, I think.
Right.
You know, the female changeling says to Dukat that, in Weyoun, look, this is more important than any of our war, but I don't really think that's true. The changelings and the founders are creating this war so they can have order the way they see it. That's one of their top priorities. I don't think Odo coming back to the fold is more important than the entire Alpha Quadrant. And it might be to this one changeling, but it doesn't really jive with what you see in general with them. So
I don't think it was. It's the female changeling will do whatever is necessary in order to achieve her goal, which was, of course, conquering the Alpha Quadrant, the Beta Quadrant. And you know, I assume she probably would have ultimately gone and just annihilated the populations of every planet in the Federation, because that seems like her temperament and her goal. And the interactions with Odo, whilst she may feel some connection to him as part of the Great Link, I also think that she had ulterior motives. That's how I always read it. It was a way for her to at least manipulate him, to find out things she needed to know, and to manipulate him. I don't think she would have ever considered giving up the fight in the war if it meant that she could achieve some sort of ultimate goal with Odo that was had something to do with just the fact that he was a fellow changeling.
Well, and I think that in the sense that, you know, she sees this, that she can draw him back in and get what she wants at the same time. So really, I mean, it all works together, right? And she can seem altruistic, but I mean, I don't really think that word exists for changelings. So
probably not. It's not in the changeling vocabulary.
Exactly. You know, one of the biggest moments, I think, for anyone, and spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Deep Space Nine, Drew Stewart, Worf killing Gowron was just a huge thing for Worf, you know, to finally kind of throw off that mantle. You know, he's been made part of Martok's house. He's in good standing with the Klingons again. And finally, Gowron has just pissed off Worf for the last time. And he takes care of business, and it is one of my favorite scenes in the show when they have that huge fight in the wardroom.
Worf's able to be a little bit more Klingon than he was in the past, and you can really see Martok's influence on Worf as well. And then the fact that, you know, Worf wasn't killing Gowron so that Worf could become Chancellor and rule the Empire. You know, the other Klingons are, Worf, Worf, they want Worf because he's, you know, killed the Chancellor, but that's not what Worf wants. And I think Worf shows a lot of his personal growth through TNG and DS9, you know, is one of the longest running characters in Star Trek. He shows a lot of his personal growth by in the end, seeing what's best for the Empire when he wants Martok to actually be the Chancellor.
Yeah, I think that's one of the coolest things, too. It would have been kind of a sweet gig to see Worf go off and be the Chancellor, but everything that we've learned about Worf over Deep Space Nine tells us that he's become okay with being more of a human Klingon than a Klingon Klingon. And it really does set up, I think, having one of the greatest characters of Deep Space Nine and probably the coolest Klingon ever, the one that you could really respect, actually be the leader of the people.
Yeah.
And I think that, to me, was incredible. Because Martok, for me, was hands down my favorite side character of Deep Space Nine. I just loved when he came on. And he really made me fall in love, I think, with Klingons as a culture, because he was the kind of Klingon I could get behind.
Yeah. Well, you could see what kind of person he was. You know, as we're talking about this, it makes me think back. Do you think that Martok becoming Chancellor, in a way, returned the Klingon Empire to the state that it was in as we headed into the undiscovered country, where you had Gorkon, and Gorkon was willing to talk to the Federation and to try to do what was best for the people and to kind of see both sides of something? I feel like Martok is that kind of person too, that Martok will try to see both sides of a situation, whereas Gowron, and you have to assume, you know, going backwards during the 24th century time, that the Klingons had kind of lost that ability.
I definitely think that that's the case. And I really see that correlation too. The fact that the Klingons are in some ways returning to a more moderate approach with Martok, the same way that Gorkon had that moderate approach.
Yeah.
And kind of reining in their passions to serve them instead of being ruled by them. Obviously Martok is very Klingon, but he's also somebody who isn't completely given over to just his passionate side. I think that's brilliant. So I loved seeing that. Chris, I think we have time for maybe one more character, and one that I'd really like to talk about, and we kind of discussed a little bit earlier, is Damar. I loved watching this character go from being the lackey of Dukat to being the leader of the Cardassian people and eventually a martyr. I thought that it was such an amazing character arc. And, you know, he's not in a ton of episodes, and yet he has a very full, rich arc by the end.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, when he came on, he was kind of like just that sidekick. And of course, when he kills Zial, it's, you see him as like this really evil person, I think. And so his redemption through the war, and especially his redemption through the final season and that final grand arc, made him, I still say Garak is my favorite Cardassian, but Garak is a unique character because he's been exiled from Cardassia. Of like real Cardassians who have been part of the Cardassian military, as we're watching it right now, I think Damar is probably my favorite, because he does become a well-rounded character, and he becomes like Garak is a true patriot, Damar becomes a true patriot as well.
Well, I really just like the fact that we just get to see another type of Cardassian, as we talked about.
Yeah.
And Damar is Cardassian through and through, but really seeing the way he grows, especially after he murders Zial, and just the way he and Kira work together after that, and the pain that he has from that, I think it's just really good writing. You know, the fact that he becomes a drunk because he can't stand to look at himself after what he's done and what he's been doing. And it's a really fantastic arc. And I think, you know, as we just kind of wrap up in the aftermath of the war, I think where we're left is that this helps move forward the character stories that Michael Piller talked about in that second season, that he wanted to do character-driven stories. And this war arc really helps do that, really gets into character-driven, character-rich stories, because it puts them all through the fire. And honestly, in any story, that's the way that you get to know your characters the best, by testing them. And the war, I think, does that really well for Deep Space Nine. So I was always glad that the Dominion War arc happens in this show.
And one more brilliant part of the Dominion War arc, a brilliant part of the writing, is how they were actually able to use this conflict to further the story of Sisko as the emissary to the Bajorans.
Right.
And actually tie those two things together. And it really fleshed out the promise of the emissary concept and the emissary storyline, and left you feeling... Well, I don't know. It's interesting. In a way, it leaves you feeling empty at the end because of the way it was resolved with Sisko, or not resolved, depending on how you want to look at it. And that kind of left you empty. But at the same time, it left you feeling fulfilled that the promise that Sisko was going to go on some great journey, some great spiritual journey as the emissary, it had a beginning in emissary and it had an end in what you leave behind. And again, looking back in hindsight, it's easy to say, I don't know how this would have worked. I'm sure they would have found a way to make it work. But I'm not sure how they would have gotten Sisko to the finish line with the whole emissary concept, and how the prophets could have meant so much to, and the influence of the prophets over the Bajorans and over the corporeal linear beings that we are in the Alpha Quadrant, would have worked without the Dominion War. So the interplay between those two elements is just really brilliant. It's amazing how they were able to bring that all to life. And, you know, what you leave behind, talking about feeling a little bit unfulfilled or empty at the end, it's actually one thing I love about What You Leave Behind. And it's such a different type of finale, you know, compared to All Good Things or Endgame. What You Leave Behind, it does kind of leave you feeling unfulfilled in a way at the end, which I think is perfect for Deep Space Nine. Because if there was any series where you want to get to the end and you want to feel like things still kind of aren't resolved neatly, then it's Deep Space Nine, because it fits the character of the series so well.
It definitely fits the character of the series, and just the idea that this is the way that real life works. You know, you don't stay somewhere forever. You know, jobs change, people change, everything changes. That's the one constant in the universe. Nothing stays the same. And so you're not going to be on the Enterprise with everybody for the rest of your life, you know, and this is more of what real life is like in the 24th century. And it does leave you bittersweet. And yet at the same time, I think you would agree, it really left you wanting to know what happens next. It gave you that feeling as well. And so to me, what a great addition to the Star Trek canon. Really, I think just taking the story, the characters and the philosophy, and putting them all to the test. And I think coming out richer and deeper and better for it.
And the last thing I'll say about the Dominion War is that I've had some Enterprise fans, and of course I'm an Enterprise fan and so are you, Matthew, but I've had some Enterprise fans say that they think that the Zindi arc gives the Dominion War a run for its money. And the Zindi arc, it works pretty well if you watch it straight through in rapid succession. But I don't think it stands up to the Dominion War, because the Dominion War, unlike the Zindi arc, which feels very fabricated to be a season of Star Trek to try to hook people in, the Dominion War, as you mentioned when we first started this discussion, is very organic. It feels like it evolved organically, not only out of the seasons of Deep Space Nine that came before it, but out of everything that was set up in the Next Generation as well, how the different powers interact with each other. And it feels like everything organically does lead to this conflict, even though the Dominion is something that was just created on DS9 that we had not heard of before. So the way it's set up feels organic. The way it plays out feels organic in real life. And it's not really neatly tied up at the end either. And so I really think that the Dominion War is, as you said, a great addition to the canon. Well, Matthew, it's been great talking about the Dominion War. Of course, we only touched on a few different moments. We could probably do, like Deep Space Nine. We could do a 9-episode orb arc about the Dominion War to cover it all. So maybe we'll gradually touch on it as the show goes on. But, you know, this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what else you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
Vic Fontaine.
Just something about kind of a wisecracking, smart-ass, you know, 60s rat packer seemed to fit with this group on Deep Space Nine.
The Ready Room.
Explorers.
It didn't cost that much. They just sent Avery down to Home Depot, and they just let Avery build the whole set. That was all done in real time.
I can imagine.
They shot it as Avery was building the set.
I can see that now.
Deck 8.
Star Trek Online.
You know, whilst Tom's officers were all in 7 of 9 skin-tight catsuits.
To the journey!
The Hirogen.
Just the sheer fact of how they tied up Seven and Tuvok was like, okay, this is not just handcuffs. Like, these people know how to tie people up. Like, that's like it's their job. Commentary, Trek Stars.
The Shrinking Man.
You're going to go from 1/7 to maybe just shy of 0. But then the next day, poof, you turn into 0.
Warp 5.
Doug Drexler.
So we were building our foam core model of the Enterprise in the art department and could literally show Brannon and Rick animations of the ship. Once it was approved, it went to Foundation Imaging.
Trek News and Views.
Half a Life.
Oh yeah, of course she does. She's like the ultimate nosy busybody on an intergalactic scale.
Literary Treks.
Rise of the Federation, A Choice of Futures.
Watching the, you know, combined Starfleet with the Andorians, the Tellarites, the Vulcans who have mothballed their Starfleet, and the humans, putting that all together, it was really interesting. And how do we decide what we're going to be? How are we going to display ourselves to the rest of the galaxy?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all those shows. You'll find them all at Trek.fm. You'll find them in iTunes, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, on Windows Phone, Xbox, just anywhere, wherever you get your podcasts, you should be able to find our shows. So go check all of those out. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have 2 new shows for you. So we hope you enjoy those. Matthew, also, let's look back to last week's show for one quick moment. We received a very interesting email from Anthony Italiani talking about Vic Fontaine. And you remember we touched on Vic in the Mirror Universe for just a moment. And we talked about how it was just kind of a fun little nod and they throw him in there and, you know, don't worry about if it makes sense. Anthony had a really interesting point that I don't think either of us considered, and it's kind of surprising that we didn't. But Anthony said that Vic's existence in the Mirror Universe is, to me, a statement that his true time and place of existence is not in the 1960s, but in the 24th century as a member of the Deep Space Nine crew. Admittedly, this is confusing scientifically, but I find it to be an interesting philosophical statement couched in an amusing scene. And I think Anthony has a really great point there.
Yeah, I like that. It does make sense that in some way that essence of who Vic is belongs in the 24th century. And I think that makes a lot of sense in a story-wise. I mean, obviously, scientifically, it doesn't make any sense. But for the story, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I really like that idea.
Yeah, it's really nice. And I think it ties into what we talked about, how Vic had become so much a part of the family and was so important in the lives of all the different characters. And yeah, maybe he really should have existed in the 24th century. So Anthony, thank you for sharing that with us. And for everyone else, you know, if you want to share your thoughts with us as well, you can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. You can choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to Matthew and me by email. You can even send us a voicemail if you'd like to. If you go to any page on our website and look along the right-hand side, you'll see a tab that says Send Voicemail. And if you click that, a box will pop up, and you can use your camera's microphone to record a message, and you can upload it to us as an MP3 file. So we'd love to hear your voice. You can also go to our forums and talk to us and the rest of the Trek FM crew and other listeners of the Orb, other Deep Space Nine fans. That's at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for the Orb, and there's one for Deep Space Nine. If you're on Facebook, you'll find us at facebook.com/trekfm. And of course, you'll find us on Twitter, tweeting away about Star Trek all the time under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, what if people would like to look you up personally and chat with you? Where should they go?
Well, Chris, if you'd like to do that, you can find me at mattrushing02 on Twitter. I also have my own personal blog, which is 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Just enjoy writing about all sorts of different things, different types of book reviews, movies, and just anything else that kind of I enjoy. So that's a good place to catch up with me. And then two, we do Literary Treks, where we talk books and comics, and it's a great show talking about the literary world of Star Trek, whether Deep Space Nine relaunch, new Enterprise book series by Christopher Bennett, those kind of things. It's fantastic. And so I hope that you'll join us there to really get to explore the only place for the Prime Universe now. Chris, when you're not embroiled in horrible combat and in nasty wars around the house, where can people find you?
How did you know about that, Matthew? Do you have spy cameras set up? Are you a changeling? Is my lamp over there? Is that actually you keeping an eye on me?
No, I just work for Section 31.
Oh, well, that explains why you wear all black all the time. Sure. Yeah. If you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username. And I also have my own website, just like you, Matthew. It's cbrianjones.com. Very easy to find. And you can find my writing on non-Star Trek stuff there, as well as some Star Trek stuff also, as well as, you know, photos. You can find out what kind of music I like and all kinds of other stuff that's going on. And check that out if you're interested. You'll also find me elsewhere on the network besides Literary Trek. You'll find me on Warp 5 every week with Kate Walsh. Warp 5 is very much like the Orb, except we talk about Enterprise. And we've had some great guests on there with us. We've had Dave Rossi, we've had Brandon Braga, and now this past week we had Doug Drexler talking about the design of the Nexa-1. And really with Doug, as we do with Brandon and Dave as well, we talk about not just Enterprise, but We even get into some Deep Space Nine stuff with Doug this week. So a lot of Star Trek general talk there also in those discussions. So check that out. You'll also find me on The Ready Room every week. And Matthew, you're there with me quite often, as are other hosts from all over the Trek FM network, as well as other special guests from throughout Star Trek. And we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series there, as well as the movies and sometimes other general topics. And we fill you in on all the news that's happening in the Star Trek world every week as well. So go check that out. Matthew, we also want to give a shout out to iTall483, who left us a great review on iTunes this past week. And iTall483 says that The Orb is a great podcast for all Niners, gave us 5 stars, and said that, you know, we talk about the show in the depth that it deserves. And one thing that I love that iTall said here is that I especially enjoy that when Matt and Chris have different opinions, their discussions always remain friendly and respectful. Take a listen. You won't regret it. And I really appreciate that. And that's one of the things I love about doing the shows with you, Matthew, is that, you know, we do have very different opinions on a lot of things, but we're always able to have a great discussion about it. And I really appreciate that too.
Well, and I think, Chris, I appreciate it too, because I think it represents the best of Star Trek. And I'm glad to be able to do that with you and still be able to say, yep, we're friends. We just disagree.
Yeah, definitely so. We also had a review from Trigger Happy Klingon, who is someone we haven't heard from in quite a while, but you may remember Trigger Happy Klingon from their review of, I believe it was The Ready Room a long time ago. Trigger Happy Klingon says that since Stork Trek isn't releasing episodes as frequently anymore, they've started listening to more Trek FM pods, and they heard about the Orb from The Ready Room, decided to give it a try. I'm so glad I did. I love listening to it. even if Matthew keeps calling Jadzia Janzia. And I think that that's just a little bit of a of an accent thing there. So Matthew, of course, you're well aware that Jadzia's name is
Sorry, I'm from Texas. Things come out weird sometimes.
Things are weird in Texas, aren't they? You deep fry Trill there, don't you?
Just the symbiont.
So thank you guys for the iTunes reviews. And if you leave us an iTunes review in a store that's not the US store, please send us a heads up and let us know it's there. Because unfortunately, we have to go to every single store individually in order to find the reviews. So we don't check every country every week. If you'd like to leave us an iTunes review, though, we would love for you to do that. A star review, a written review, it helps other fans of Deep Space Nine find the orb. So please drop by. It only takes like 30 seconds, and we really appreciate that. One more thing, Matthew, before we let everyone go, we'd like to ask you to please support our sponsors for this week's show. Your support of our sponsors is very important to helping us bring the orb to you every week. First, there's Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, an online store, really anything you can imagine. Trek FM is built on Squarespace. My personal website is, my company website is, and I build client websites there as well. I've been doing it for about 6 years now. I love it. I know you're going to love it as well. Go create your own space today. I promise you, you're going to be really impressed with the tools. Go to squarespace.com for your free 14-day trial. There's no credit card required. Try it free. And then when you sign up, use offer code TREK8 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And we thank Squarespace for their support of The Orb and Trek FM. Also, please visit trekfan.org. Now, we all love to sit around and talk about Star Trek, but if we really want to get to that Star Trek future, we really need to do more. And Trek Fan is, you know, it's not just a fan club. It's really an adventure that you get to embark upon with fellow fans, where you'll collaborate to solve puzzles and complete real-life mission objectives. And along the way, you'll win great prizes. So turn your love for Star Trek into something that can help us move towards that Star Trek future. Support us, support Trek Fan by going to trekfan.org, solve that first puzzle, and take the next step on your adventure. And we thank Trek Fan as well for their support of the orb. And lastly, if you would personally like to support the network and our programming, visit trek.fm/donate. We have 8 new alien-themed badges as a thank you for your contributions, and they're perfect for your shirt, for your bag, for your wartime gray Deep Space Nine uniform. They're 44mm badges with original illustrations by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. We also have A5 size art prints of these aliens now as well. They're much larger views than you get on the buttons. And you can choose if you want buttons or if you want art prints. There are different levels of donations for you to choose from. Go to trek.fm/donate, and your contributions help us cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the orb to you every week.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.